Mr. O'Sullivan's cold iron aura never affected the sword's cloak, and he handled it often. You have that talisman, she says, pointing to my amulet, and you can wear it all you want afterward. But I need you to remove it now, so that we can target you for the ritual.
Oh, all right.
I take off my necklace and put it over Orla's head, asking her to keep it safe for me.
Your hound will need to remain outside the circle, by the way.
I ask Orla to wait for me outside the circle with my amulet and scavenger, and once she does, I feel acutely vulnerable, because the Sisters of the Three Auroras could target me with something else now, and this might be the end of a long con on the gullible young druid. I don't know whether to be proud of my paranoia or saddened that I think so poorly of these women, who've done nothing but be kind to me so far. I mean, except for that time Claudia snared me with those charmed lips of hers. The question, I suppose, is whether getting a divination cloak is worth possibly dying for. Considering all I've already gone through to get it, getting bitten by a snake god, I think I have to answer yes. I certainly can't continue to be the method by which Atticus's many enemies track him down. And until I get this cloak, I can't even begin to free myself from all his entanglements. This god, or that fey monstrosity, or the other evil wizard bro, will continue to use me to get to him, unless I do something about it. And fuck that. I'm not gonna be their stepping stone, or hostage, or anything else. I want myself removed from the picture. In practical terms, not getting the cloak would probably be just as deadly as letting the sisters have their free shot at me now.
This will take about an hour, and all you'll hear is Polish from now on,
Melina says, rising and taking her place in the circle.
Oh, and one more thing,
Berta says. When I turn around, she waves at the chopped up plants on the altar.
We have to throw some of this stuff in the pot there, and it might smell bad. We have to sprinkle some of this on you, too.
But you won't smell bad,
Martina hastens to reassure me.
Only the boiling stuff smells bad. We need you to have some of the raw stuff on you for focusing.
Oh, okay, I say. You did all this for Fragora?
We sure did, Melina replies. It's only an hour of work. Mr. O'Sullivan had to do much more than that to earn it. And you had to do much more as well.
That is certainly the truth. But as Martina dumps a load of yarrow and some other herbs I can't immediately identify into my hair and on my shoulders, I say, no, I mean this. I jerk a thumb at my beflowered hair. You sprinkled herbs on the scabbard and had the cauldron and everything in Tempe?
Yes, we had a secluded spot in the desert for our outdoor rituals.
I cough, then sneeze from the pollen.
Maybe I could use your shower afterward?
Of course.
They begin in earnest after reminding me once more to remain still, and it's a slow, peaceful time listening to the language and absorbing its rhythms. The longer it continues, the more relaxed I feel, because building takes longer than destroying. If they meant me harm, I would have felt it much sooner. Orla falls asleep, lulled by their voices. Planes fly overhead on occasion, and birds chirp, but otherwise it's just 13 witches chanting in Polish, and an awful stench rising from the boiling cauldron. Near the very end, I feel a gentle pressure all over, and my eardrums pop in and then pop out again. All of the coven raise their arms at that point and smile at the sky, a familiar ecstasy written on their faces. Goddesses have worked their will through them. When Gaia speaks through me, I feel the same way.
That's it, Melina says. You're blessed. Or cloaked, whatever you want to call it.
I change my vision over to the magical spectrum and look at my hand, not knowing quite what to look for. I never got to see the cloak on Fragora.
Feel free to test it with any seer or deity you wish,
Melina goes on.
We guarantee our work.
There, floating above my aura, the sheerest layer of lilac gossamer tells me that the Zorias have indeed blessed me. Or, pending confirmation, I should say, that lilac bit wasn't there before, and something has been done to me. I will definitely confirm it, but I am already confident that they have dealt straight with me. The cold iron test would be prudent, however.
Congratulations,
a couple of the witches say, and I smile in response, but don't say anything yet. Orla, will you bring me my amulet, please? I ask as I get to my feet and brush flowers and pollen dust off my shoulders and shake out my hair. She wakes and ambles over, tail wagging.
Is it time for breakfast yet?
I think it might be. Thank you, I tell her, retrieving my necklace. I drape it over my head and let it take its accustomed place just below the hollow of my throat. I watch my aura, examining that lavender layer closely on one arm and then the other. It remains strong and doesn't flicker. My thanks to the Zorias, I finally say to Melina, shoulders sagging with relief. And my thanks to you all.
Our pleasure. Fulfilling a contract always feels good.
What are we doing after breakfast?
Orla asks, and I suspect she's not really interested in the answer, but rather wishes to keep me focused on breakfast. We're going on a secret mission, because now we can keep secrets, I tell her.
Chapter 17. Prague is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. For my money, it's in the top 5. The architecture is goth as fuck. Pointy bits at the top and stone curlicues underneath. And the squares are full of bronze sculptures that celebrate ideas more than military conquest. It's a setting that whispers of magic and mystic euphoria. And bloody danger, too. It was where Leif Helgerson had been turned to a vampire 1,000 years ago. Oberon and I arrived via the tethered trees of Petrine Hill, which is situated on the west side of the Vltava River, after nightfall. And also after I had taken some time to catch up on sleep and healing. It was overcast, and some mist had rolled in, clinging to the trees, and we both took a moment to appreciate the smell.
Oh. Have we ever been here before?
Oberon asked. I've been here many times, but this is a first for you.
Then I must ask you what I always ask when we go someplace new. What kind of food do they have here that I would like?
I think you'd like the beef goulash. Slow-roasted, tender beef in a thick, spicy gravy. I began to pick my way downhill toward the Charles Bridge, and Oberon trotted alongside.
That sounds great. Goulash, me Atticus. Is that right? Is goulash a verb?
Not normally, but now that you say it, I think it should be.
Yes, I'm looking forward to goulashing for as long as I can.
We'll see if we can arrange it. We have to be vampire hunters first. We crossed the river by way of the Charles Bridge, a wonderful structure graced on both sides by Baroque sculptures and handy lights for night walks. And I paused at the statue of St. John of Nepomuk to point out something to Oberon. See these plaques at the base? I said, where there were bronze bas-reliefs of St. John's death. Notice how parts of them are shiny?
Yeah, why are those parts so clean?
Because people keep touching them. And all those hands have polished those parts to a golden glow. The legend is that if you touch the image on the right side, the one depicting the priest being thrown into the river, you'll have good luck and return to Prague soon.
Oh, so what's going on with the left? Hey, that shiny part on the left is a hound.
Yep. People touch the image on the right for luck, but then they also pet the hound on the left because... hounds are so awesome. That hound has been petted by millions of people over the centuries. That's why he's so shiny.
Wow! That's a pretty lucky hound! This is now my favorite statue!
I leaned forward and gave the hound on the statue a quick scratch behind the ears. Then I touched the priest on the right. I'm not a Catholic, but I could use all the luck I could get. And in theory, at least, the big guy in the sky was rooting for me, along with the gods of several other pantheons, thanks to Rebecca Dane. The least he deserved from me was a courtesy greeting. All right, let's move on. But keep your nose open for dead guys instead of goulash. I'm counting on you to give me a heads up before they attack. Once we got to the eastern shore, we plowed down the cobbled Karlova Ulica, past innumerable shops hawking expensive crystal amber necklaces or cheap souvenirs, and barkers trying to get us to eat at one of the many restaurants or take in a theater show. I admired the astronomical clock in the old town square, lit up at night, and people either admired or shied away from Oberon as we passed. Tourists enjoyed beers or dinner at one of the many outdoor seating areas there, and the locals enjoyed the money the tourists spent. After crossing the square, we continued down Zeletsa Ulica, and once we reached the Grand Café Orient, we took a left up Kravla Dvorska Ulica, which would bring us to the Grand Hotel Bohemia from behind. It loomed above us on the narrow street, 6 stories of a yellow cream, its facade curved around the corner it occupied. We stopped before rounding the corner to the entrance. All right, Oberon, Star Wars pop quiz. Which phrase is used most often in the movies?
Oh, I know. I've got a bad feeling about this, or some variation of that.
Correct. And that's my feeling right now. I don't trust Leaf, or any vampire, really. So I'd like you to be my ace in the hole here, in case something goes sideways.
Well, you should have a bad feeling. I smell dead people now.
That's somewhat encouraging. If the vampires are here, maybe one of them is Theophilus. I can pull a Julie Daubigny and end it.
Heck yes, be like Julie.
But in case something goes wrong, I'm going to camouflage you and leave you here. If I have to retreat, I'll come back this way. And I want you to knock down the first person who's following me. Don't bite or engage them, just knock them over, and then catch up with me.
Got it. Well, I can do that. And then you can goulash me.
With Oberon kept safe, which was truly my intention in leaving him there, not that he protect my retreat, I proceeded to the double doors of the Grand Bohemia, and cast camouflage to give me some time to scope out the place, unobserved. The outer doors opened into an unusual glass-enclosed foyer, with 5 angled panels, 2 of which were doors leading to the left and right of the center panel. The reception desk and staircase waited straight ahead across a tiled floor, and flush with the front of the building to either side were carpeted sitting areas with little cocktail tables. The furniture was upholstered in rich red and gold frilly patterns, with matching heavy drapes framing the large arched windows. A huge portrait of Karl IV, the 14th century Holy Roman Emperor who ruled from Bohemia, gazed benevolently upon the hotel guests and reminded them that Prague had once been the capital of the Western world. In the back of the room, to the left of reception and the staircase, a doorway with café bar emblazoned above it announced that potables could be had, and I glimpsed a bored bartender behind the taps. The seating areas on either side of the lobby were occupied by 6 individuals each, and once I switched my vision to the magical spectrum, I saw that every single one of them was a vampire. I pulled out the stake and wondered where to begin, which, if any of them, was Theophilus. I didn't get a chance to find out. One of the vampires on the right was wearing slightly odd glasses that I first dismissed as pretentious fashion, but they were modern infrared goggles. He couldn't see through my camouflage binding, but he could sure see my heat signature, standing there and not actually entering the lobby. He could no doubt smell me, too. I caught this as he pulled out a phone, thumbed a speed dial number, and then said in German,
"Er ist am Eingang. Ja, machen wir."
He rang off, nodded at the others on his right, and they rose together. A quick glance at the left side of the lobby confirmed that the vampires there were doing the same, and my bad feeling got infinitely worse. German goggle vamp shouted,
"Schieß auf die Tür!"
And the guns came out from under jackets, and I ducked just in time to avoid the worst of the fire. They wound up shooting each other, more than me, but I still took a bullet in the left hamstring as I threw myself at the door and crawled out to the sidewalk. Once there, I realized I couldn't stand up, not only because of the bullet in my leg, but because if I did, the goggles guy would see me in infrared and have a clear shot as I ran by the front windows to where Oberon was. My scent would help them find me too. So the best option was to stop being human for a bit, until I could ditch them. I triggered the charm that changed my shape to a sea otter, and wriggled out of my clothes on three limbs instead of four, leaving them on the sidewalk for the vampires to smell. Then I scampered as quickly as I could manage, hobbled as I was, along the base of the building so that my heat signature could not be seen through the windows, carrying the stake in my mouth. I hoped no one but vampires had been hurt. Just as I reached the corner, vampires burst out of the hotel entrance, accompanied by a human, one whose voice I knew too well.
"O'Sullivan!"
he called, and I peeked back around the corner to confirm it was him. Verna Drasha stood among his vampire entourage, looking up and down the intersection, plainly not in custody in Toronto anymore. And while he was no longer an arcane life leech, he was still a gigantic thorn in my side, and showed a disturbing talent for outfoxing me. He must have been waiting out of sight, perhaps in the bar somewhere. And that was who the goggled vampire called when he spotted me. I really should have killed him when I had the chance. Well, Drasha could have this round. I was so extremely outgunned that there was no use in trying to tilt a lopsided battle in my favor. I should count avoiding the ambush as a win. "Oberon, let's go," I said to him through our mental link. "Don't wait to stop anyone. I'm going to fly out of here, and you follow along on the streets, okay? Try not to knock any tourists over."
"Okay."
I shifted directly from otter to owl since my arms were in good shape, and I wouldn't have to depend on that damaged left leg. I'd worry about healing it later. As I took wing in the direction of the Vltava River, I heard Drasha launch into a series of taunts.
"You can't win this war, O'Sullivan! One way or another, we'll get to you!"
He made a good point. My goal was still a good one, but I couldn't win using current methods. I'd have to try another way to get to Theophilus, because they had been waiting for me at the Grand Hotel Bohemia, with guns and infrared and Drasha's personal force of undead Austrian muscle. Which meant that Leif had betrayed me again.
Chapter 18. There is a certain freedom granted in privacy, a sense of fulfillment and ease that comes with the simple knowledge that no one is watching. It's why we feel all right about singing in the shower. And in this modern world, where we are constantly under surveillance of one kind or another, I suppose a compelling argument could be made that both our privacy and our freedom are illusions. Atticus and I don't worry about conventional surveillance too much. Stay off the internet, use burner phones, and pay cash for everything you can. And that'll at least make them work to find you. Using assumed identities is a huge help as well. But I haven't had true privacy, true freedom, until now, with a divination cloak shielding me from the prying eyes of gods and seers of all kinds. And I know just how I want to celebrate that freedom. I want to pluck out the metaphorical thorn that's been embedded in my psyche for years, and then see if I can't find my way back to a happy place. Laksha's question about where I am on my own spiritual journey has lingered in my mind, and I've been thinking about it. There was a rebuke there, and a well-deserved one. It put me in mind of Whitman's rhetorical question about judgment in I Sing the Body Electric. Do you know so much yourself that you call the meanest ignorant?
Nope. I certainly do not.
And the primary problem is that I do not know enough of myself. I have old wounds that have never fully healed, and I need to address them before I can move to help others. And in truth, there is no balance that I can achieve but my own. I have long delayed seeking that balance in favor of more pressing business, but I feel that it's finally time to take care of it. Being able to take care of it was one of the primary reasons I became a druid, but I have purposely waited since becoming bound to Gaia to ensure that I would not act rashly. Instead, I have coolly planned a course of action that will serve Gaia and also serve my personal need to give my stepfather the finger. As a child, when I came to live at his place in Kansas, the slightly smaller one, not the sprawling monstrosity he bought my senior year, I quickly saw that my mother was a prize instead of a person to him. And I was a burden he had to tolerate if he wanted the prize. He never laid a finger on me. I'm more fortunate than so many others in that regard. But the most love I was able to ever wring out of his face was a look of mild disgust. Never a kind word. Maybe it was because I was a tangible reminder that he had not always possessed my mother. Any interest he gave me was feigned, and that was only in the presence of others. I know my mom must have seen something good in him besides his bank account. Her regard for him, at least, wasn't feigned. I think she admires single-minded determination. My real dad had it, and so does Beau. And I suppose I possess a fair measure of it myself. The only time I think I ever saw him smile at me was when he was waving goodbye as I left Kansas for Arizona State. So, yes, I have hurt feelings, which I probably should have sought to address long ago. His aggressive disdain, heaped on my real father's distracted abandonment, did nothing good for my psyche. It's why I took to playing alone outside as much as possible, enjoying an area that wasn't so firmly under Beau's control. Later, it wasn't playing, but reading in a treehouse that my mother had hired someone to build for me. Beau certainly wouldn't do it. I stayed out past dark and burned through a whole lot of batteries for my flashlight. I felt more at home there than in the bedroom he allowed me to sleep in. But there again, Beau Thatcher found a way to be hurtful. He has long regarded the whole world, including the people on it, as resources that exist for him and his cronies to exploit so that they may have their sprawling estates and luxury cars and congressmen in their pockets. His moral compass always points to himself. He is his own true north. He helped fund 3 or 4 corrupt scientists who denied the reality of climate change, giving his company a thin shield of shady science to protect his short-term profits. And now that the world is racked by freakish storms, convulsing from drought and floods and rising sea levels with massive die-offs in the oceans and extinctions continuing on land, he still refuses to own up to his share of the responsibility for it, and his money gives him the privilege to ignore the troubles that most people face. The world will never make him pay for his company's oil spills and carbon pollution because American laws are written to protect men like him. But druidic law allows the punishment of despoilers. And I'm a druid. The application of those laws is up to me. Atticus feels that pursuing despoilers of the earth is futile, since there are so many of them and so few druids. And when I look at cold numbers on paper, I see the sense of that. But my heart cannot meekly accept criminal pollution as inevitable. That would mean accepting that Beau Thatcher is a force of nature instead of a single shitty human being. And I suppose that is where Atticus and I disagree. "Ready for a bunch of running around, Orla?" I ask my hound.
"Sure. Run where? Trees?"
"Probably not so many trees. Lots of plains with prairie dogs."
"Name for those things is so strange. They aren't really dogs."
Human language is funny that way. What kind of beef jerky should we pack? I ask. I need lots of protein to aid in rebuilding my torn tissues. What's your favorite flavor?
Any beef flavor is good, except no horseradish or mustard.
Great. Beef for you, turkey jerky for me. I fill up a pack with water and jerky at a convenience store, and then we shift to Kansas, following a prearranged operating procedure. I have memorized the locations of every well and refinery owned by Thatcher Oil and Gas. I contact Amber, the elemental of the Great Plains, and let her know what I'm planning. I'm going to sabotage all the drills by unbinding their inner workings, and then, with Amber's help, I'll cap the wells with a very hard stone. If they try to drill more, they'll ruin a few bits in the process, and Amber will let me know. I'll sabotage the refineries and heavy equipment as well, so that all the machinery they own becomes useless hunks of metal. Production will shut down and stay that way until the company completely replaces its infrastructure. No one gets hurt. Everything will simply stop and cause the company to spend a huge amount of capital to get going again. But Thatcher Oil and Gas bought that equipment over many years instead of all at once, and I'm hoping it'll be too expensive to refit one of the last remnants of a dying industry. If they do pony up, I'll cripple everything again. And again, until they go bankrupt and shut down, or else figure out that it's wiser to invest in solar or wind. It is exciting at the beginning to shut down the wells, but after a few hours it turns into drudgery. The iron horses aren't guarded. They're just doing their monotonous work on the plains, and in most cases we don't even have to sneak up on them. I'm not able to reshape the iron at all. I can only unbind the carbon from the steel and create a melted slurry inside that becomes a useless cold slag. It is not challenging and does nothing to undo the damage the company's already done. It's simply time-consuming. But the constant shifting, running, and unbinding is mentally taxing, and all that keeps me going is anticipating the look on my stepfather's face when I appear and tell him it was me. I can see, however, why Atticus never dedicated himself to this sort of work. Cleaning up messes would be more immediately rewarding, but would do nothing to prevent it happening again. Sabotaging equipment stops the abuse of the earth, but gives very little emotional payoff, apart from a grim satisfaction that I've taken one tiny step in a journey of many millions. At the end of a very long day, Orla wants to see llamas, for some reason. So we spend the night in Ecuador, in a meadow in the foothills of the Andes, where it's summertime and the evening is mild. Orla stretches out in the grass with me, and watches a wild herd of llamas sip from a small lake filled with runoff water.
They kind of look like sheep, except someone stretched out their necks and legs.
Or maybe someone took llamas and squished them to make sheep.
Oh, yeah. What came first, the llama or the sheep?
That's an excellent question. Perhaps I'll ask Gaia sometime. It's relaxing there, and I take the time to meditate a bit after I build a fire for us. Tomorrow will be an important day for me, and I want it to go well. I vocalize with Orla what I want to happen, because it helps to say it out loud. I want Thatcher Oil and Gas shut down, and though I know it'll be difficult to confront my stepfather, I want to maintain control and not resort to violence.
Okay, but remind me why that matters again. Sometimes you have to break a neck if you want to eat.
It matters because violence, or the threat of it, is how men tend to solve problems. Like right now, Atticus is feeling pushed around by this vampire Theophilus, so he's pushing back just as hard, if not harder. Not sure if there's any other way to handle the situation, but I don't think he's looking especially hard for one. And I admit that sometimes violence is the only option, and for that reason I'm glad I'm quite good at it. But I don't want to make that my default solution. Whenever I can, I want to win with druidry, rather than ass-kicking.
I know what you mean about violence being the only option sometimes. You just can't talk to squirrels, you know?
I probably could. And that's something I need to keep in mind. I have a lot of options. Violence is a well-traveled road, and I'd rather take the one less traveled. Orla is not up to speed on her Robert Frost poetry, so she misses the reference.
I like well-traveled roads, though. Lots of smells to enjoy.
They do have their charms. Let's dream about them. We snuggle up together in the grass, and I try counting llamas instead of sheep to get to sleep, and continue healing my muscles from that encounter in Germany. When the morning comes, I shapeshift into a jaguar and give the llamas a friendly chase with Orla, just to get everyone's blood pumping. Then I change back, get dressed, and we travel through Tiernanogue to get to Wichita, Kansas, where the offices of Beau Thatcher, my stepfather, can be found. I charge up the silver storage of Skowaja and use the bindings carved into it at Flittish's instruction to make Orla and myself completely invisible. Then we enter the steel and glass tower of Thatcher Oil and Gas, travel up to the 10th floor, and stroll right past his secretary's desk. When I open the door to his office, he's on the phone, red-faced and angry, practically shouting into the receiver. He's hearing that his entire oil production is at a standstill and can't be fixed. Customers will begin to get their oil elsewhere when they can't fill orders. Good. He's already having a bad day. I haven't seen him in the flesh for more than 12 years, and his flesh has suffered the ravages of time. He used to have very sharp features, bladed cheeks, and a keen edge to the ridge of his nose, but the lines have softened and swelled now. There's heavy luggage under his eyes, and his hair clings to his scalp like thin, wavy patches of pond moss, if the moss were pale gray. His mouth still has the same cruel curl to it, though, and it frowns at the door when we walk through and close it behind us. His eyes drop away, seeing nothing, and he resumes his bilious shouting into the phone.
Right now, I don't fucking care how it happened. I care about getting it fixed, goddammit. Tell me when you'll have it fixed.
He pauses to listen briefly and then interrupts.
Hey, are you a fucking engineer, or aren't you? You're supposed to know how shit works. You can't tell me you don't know how to fix it without me suspecting that you're incompetent. You understand? Now you better know how to fix it and tell me when it'll be fixed before the hour's up. Call me then!
He slams down the phone and growls,
"Shit!"
in his frustration. It makes all of yesterday's work well worth it, and I smile. That's when I drop my invisibility and Orla's and say, "Hello, Bo." He startles, his eyes going wide, and says,
"Who the hell are you?"
"I'm Granuel. Don't you remember? The stepdaughter you sent off to college in Arizona, oh, so long ago?"
"Bullshit. She's dead. Tell me who you really are and how you got that big damn dog in here."
I walk forward and seat myself in the plush leather chair opposite his mahogany desk. Orla sits next to me on the left. "Come on, Bo. Believe your eyes. I'm Granuel, and I'm not dead. And no, Mom doesn't know. I'd appreciate it if you kept this between us." He takes a good long look at me and shakes his head.
"I don't believe it. Where the hell you been? Why'd you let us think you were dead?"
"That's all secret stuff. The kind of thing where if I told you, I'd have to kill you."
"Whatever," he says, waving my answer away.
His hands drop below the desk after that, and I almost comment, but he continues to say,
"I'm not really interested."
"Oh, I know. You never were. There would be no 'Welcome home, Granuel. I'm so glad you're not dead,' coming from him." He scowls at me.
"What do you want? I'm busy."
"No, you're not. You have an oil empire that's producing no oil right now, so you're not busy at all. You have me to thank for that."
"What?"
every well and refinery owned by T.O.&G stopped working yesterday. Am I right?
How do you know that?
Because I made it happen.
How?
How is not the question you should be asking. You should be asking why. And it's because enough is enough. Or because of karma, or whatever you want to call it. I want you to stop. Reinvest in solar and wind. Open a chain of hardware stores. I don't care. Just stop being a blight on the earth. He sneers at me in disgust.
You're a goddamn hippie, aren't you?
I'm a druid.
What you are is full of shit and about to be arrested, he says.
The office doors burst open behind me and four security guards rush in, presumably in response to a silent alarm he'd triggered behind his desk. They're fit and well-paid professionals, not the slow and soggy kind. Orlis spins and growls at them, and that makes them pull up for a second. I have Scowager in hand, and when they see that, along with the tomahawk I have at my hip, they pull out those hard plastic police batons. The one closest to Orla looks like he's going to use it on her, so I slide over there and poke him gently in the gut, forcing him back a couple of steps. Let's be kind to animals, sir. They start shouting at me to drop my weapon. Orla barks at them, Bo yells at them to stop fucking around and take me down, and I grin. Their uniforms are awful polyester blends, and I can't mess with them, but their shoes are made of leather. Natural material there, even if treated with chemicals. Almost identical to the leather of the chair I was just sitting in. I bind the closest guy's right foot to the back of the chair, high up, and the binding simultaneously yanks his foot up in the air and the back of the chair down. They rush to meet, both toppling over and dragging across the floor toward each other, effectively blocking the other guards from getting to me. I repeat the binding on the others, and soon they're all immobilized and cursing, kicking at the chair. They won't stay that way forever. Eventually, they'll slip out of their shoes. But I plan to be gone by then. I turn around to bid Bo a mocking farewell, since I've delivered my message, and discover that he's pulled a gun out of his desk, and he's pointing it at me. My amusement at the guards disappears.
Not so funny now, is it? He says. You should have stayed dead, Granuel. Pretty thing like you's gonna hate what's left of your life in prison. Now put that fucking stick down slow, or I'll pop you in the knee. My boys there'll testify I had no choice. And drop that axe, too. And we'll talk about what you've done to the wells.
His condescending sneer, a frequent nightmare from my youth, sets off a rumbling quake of rage inside me. And the careful admonitions I had made to myself last night float down the River Leafy. Okay. Okay, I say, and slowly begin to sink to my knees, seeming to comply. Then I mutter the words to trigger invisibility, and as soon as I wink out of his sight, I drop down behind the desk and roll out of the gun's line of fire, moving to my right and his left, away from my hound.
Hey, now, he says, standing up and waving that gun around, searching for me.
Orla is growling at him, and through our mental link, I tell her not to move.
Don't fuck with me! No telling who could get hurt, he says, the gun barrel drifting in Orla's direction.
It's not a direct threat, but it's not subtle either. And if I was angry before, now I'm ready to erupt. I come up on his left, raise Scowager, and bring it down hard on his extended right wrist. It's a blow across his body, but that's why long staffs are handy. He shoots around into the top of his desk before letting go, at the same time making a high squeal of pain because I've shattered the bones in his wrist. He clutches it, takes a step back, and I drop Scowager to lay into him with my fists. Doing so makes me visible, and he sees me coming, but not in time to do anything about it, except reflexively widen his eyes. I crunch my fist into his face, and he lets out another cry as he collapses. I follow him to the ground and keep punching him in the body as I shout,
No! Telling! Who could smack get hurt! Whomp! Granuel!
Orla's voice intrudes, and I look up at her.
You said you didn't want to be violent. Oh.
I say in a tiny voice, rearing back and realizing that Beau has curled up into a defensive fetal position. I have just beaten the hell out of an old man. An evil old man, to be sure, but I've failed miserably at keeping the moral high ground. Now the entire confrontation will be about my violence, instead of his decades of ruining the earth for profit. I'm torn, because it felt so good to lay into him like I've always wanted to. But I also wanted to be better than that.
Also, watch out for the dudes!
Looking up, I see that a couple of the guards have won free of their shoes, and one is circling around the desk to get behind me while the other is moving to the door. He opens it a crack, shouts to the secretary to call for backup, and closes it again. The other two guards will be free in another couple of seconds. I need to leave. The guy who's trying to pounce on me from behind moves too slow. His body language screams that I spooked him with the shoe thing. He can't explain that shit with science, so he's got a clenched teeth aggro face and nostrils flaring like a bull. Still, when I scramble to my feet, retrieving Scowager, he somehow summons the courage to try to bash me in the head with his baton. I knock it aside, and then before he can swing it back around, I whip the bottom end of my staff up into his unprotected groin. He goes down with a whimper. All the aggro gone, and the totality of his existence now consumed with the throbbing of his bruised balls. Movement in my peripheral vision alerts me that one of the guards is climbing over the chair and lunging for the desk. I get there a split second faster and snatch up Beau's dropped gun.
Nuh-uh,
I say, pointing it at him.
Back off. Drop the batons. All of you away from the door. Move fast now, or I'll drop you with a bullet to the knee.
I gesture. They scoot. And I mentally tell Orla to head for the door. She growls as she passes them, essentially exchanging positions with the guards, and stands in front of the door. The three guards, the last one finally free of the chair, keep their hands up and their eyes on me. Beau is still lying on the ground, moaning. With the guards disarmed and Orla out of danger, I take my eyes off the three guards, just long enough to carefully step past the one I'd nutted. Couldn't have him tripping me up. When I reach the door, I'm afraid Beau might not take the proper lesson from this.
You were right, Beau,
I say, calling to him.
Grania Whale is dead. I'm someone else. Someone you can't control.
A line from Whitman floats up into my consciousness, and I seize on it.
I help myself to material and immaterial. No guard can shut me off. No law prevent me.
Bye now, Beau.
Shut down, Thatcher Oil and Gas,
and move on. Out the door when it opens, Orla, I tell her. I take care to turn on the safety, shove the gun in my waistband, and open the door. Orla trots out smartly. The secretary is on the phone calling for reinforcements, but looks up at our exit.
Oh, God, she's here!
The phone drops from her fingers, and she raises her hands.
Please don't kill me!
Nobody's dead. Just don't move, I say, closing the door and concentrating on the wood, a paneled composite, I realize, rather than the solid hardwood I was expecting. I'm still not good with binding the unseen, so I forget the lock and perform a different binding instead, fusing the wood of the door to the jamb. Beau and his minions will have to be hacked out of there to get out. My hand is still on the doorknob, and someone tries to open it from the other side as I work. I maintain my hold on the knob until I complete my binding, and then he can rattle the doorknob all he wants after that.
Call 911!
The guard shouts from behind the door.
We need an ambulance!
Binding complete, I let go of the door and turn to the secretary. Did you hear that? She nods at me, eyes huge, like hard-boiled eggs.
Well, better get on it then. Tell them to bring something to hack through the door.
I head for the stairwell, ruling out the elevator as a death trap. The secretary watches me go until I'm past her desk, then she grabs for her phone.
Move down these as fast as you can manage, Orla, I tell her as I open the door, but stay in contact with my hand.
As soon as it clicks shut behind us, I speak the binding that will turn us invisible again, drawing on a dwindling reserve of energy. I'm still somewhat stiff from my encounter with Velis, despite my opportunities to heal, so I can't move as quickly as I would like. After a few flights down, we hear the door above slam open and boots clomping after us. Additional security must have arrived via the elevator, only to be told by the secretary that we went downstairs. On the third floor landing, I hear a door open below and hold up, telling Orla to stop.
Squish yourself against the wall right here, away from the banister, I tell her.
More boots pound upstairs, and soon three black-clad security guards round the banister stick to the rail and hurry right past us on the landing, soon to meet the other guys coming down. I wait for them to round the next flight before giving Orla the all-clear.
Let's keep going down, but try to go quietly.
My toenails click,
Orla mourns.
I think it'll be okay. Their boots are loud. Plus, they're shouting at one another now, wondering where we are.
We sneak out without incident after that. I toss Beau's gun into a public trash can, the kind with a lid on it so people can't see it in there, and I keep a hand on the back of Orla's neck to guide her a couple of blocks away, out of the immediate vicinity of the building and security cameras. The invisibility melts away in an alleyway before I can dispel it, the energy completely drained from the silver reservoir of Scowaja. And then, as sirens wail on their way to aid my stepfather, I shudder from the adrenaline come down and wonder what I should be feeling. I sink to my knees and wrap my arms around Orla's neck.
This is so strange, I tell her. I feel terrible and awesome at the same time.
Pretty sure that's wrong.
Why?
I'm supposed to feel just terrible for utterly failing to be a good person up there.
You're a good person, the best person.
But I didn't need to be violent. Even when he pulled that gun, I could have used druidry instead of my weapon. Thrashing him felt good, but still I'm horrified at my lack of control. Thank you for stopping me from doing anything more. The fact that he needed an ambulance was bad enough.
You're welcome. Maybe it was a mistake. Everyone makes mistakes. That one time I chewed up your slippers was a mistake. It was fun to chew them, but once I knew it was wrong, I didn't do it again.
That makes me laugh. You have a point there. I think, not for the first time, that Oberon and Orla are far more emotionally stable than humans. Hounds have much to teach us, as do all the creatures of the earth. I've made my share of mistakes, but thank all the gods that I have yet to regret choosing to become a druid. I get to my feet and dust off my knees.
Okay, back to the park, and then we shift out of here.
We might be observed by traffic cameras on the way, and authorities might trace my path later, but there's no helping it. I have nothing left to keep us camouflaged across the city. During the jog to the park, I continue to ping back and forth between elation and guilt. I'd undeniably done a good thing for Gaia by shutting down the operations of TONG, but in hindsight, my visit with Beau was definitely a mistake. He doesn't feel remorse over what he's done. He doesn't see that I'm right, only that I can punch him whenever I want and get away with it, and that I can make leather shoes stick to his upholstery. Maybe my leaving that binding in place, along with sealing his office door, will be a nice reminder that I'm not playing by the rules he's used to. That might be the only thing that gets through to him, short of driving his company bankrupt. I do hope that he decides to get out of oil without further prompting, but it's more likely that I'll have to slowly choke his company to death. And no one should doubt that I will do it, with purpose and vigor. And justice for Gaia. What truly worries me is the idea that the elemental's habit of calling me fierce druid isn't merely a badass honorific. Maybe it points to something darker in my makeup, something latent that I didn't realize lurked within me until events conspired to yank it to the surface. The thing to do, if I must be fierce, is to channel it into virtuous channels. I need to study Polish and memorize Szymborska to improve my druidry, and I have to fight Gaia's battles until I can't fight anymore. Orla and I return to the same peaceful meadow in Ecuador to seek some balance after the violence of Wichita. The runoff lake is cold, but I feel cleaner after a swim. And after whiling the day away under a tree in meditation, I open my eyes at dusk and smile, having come to an emotional mountaintop where I can breathe easy. It was ugly work, dealing with Beau, and I certainly could have controlled myself better. but confronting him was a wall I had to climb to see the splendor of the other side. I think I'll take Orla's wise advice and not dwell on the mistakes I made while scaling that wall. I will focus instead on not repeating them. I suspect most people have someone like Beau Thatcher in their lives, a person standing in between who you used to be and who you want to be, guarding the wall and proclaiming that you shall forever be imprisoned by their expectations and obligations. Crossing to the other side will always be a struggle and fraught with dangers that may leave scars. But oh, the reward when you leap over that wall or break through it and shed the burdens of the past. I am light and free. And my path ahead is smooth and wide through a land of burgeoning promise. Chapter 19. Sometimes you get an idea so simple that you wonder why you never thought of it before. What is the point, I asked myself, of having your own goddess of the hunt if you don't ask her to show off once in a while? Flittish was unlikely to do anything but follow her own whimsy, but since Briett was on record as wanting the vampire threat eliminated, and it was a genuine challenge, I figured it wouldn't hurt to ask for Flittish's help in tracking down Theophilus. A quick trip to Tir na n'Og to present the problem to her was in order. Instead of asking her to help, I challenged her to beat me. I haven't been able to find an ancient vampire for months now, I said. I wondered if you could succeed where I failed. And, as it turned out, Flittish was longing for something to occupy her attention. She was prone to ennui after hunting everything on the earth over a couple thousand years, and she needed something to distract her from dwelling on Fan's betrayal of Briett anyway. She accepted my challenge straight away and accompanied me back to Prague, bringing a rather moody Pirun along. I worried at first that she was breaking Briett's offer of sanctuary by having him leave Tir na n'Og. He was supposed to stay there, and sanctuary was forfeit if he left, but she said not to worry about it, so I didn't. I took her to the Grand Hotel Bohemia and said we'd be looking for the oldest vampire there, if that was a trail she could isolate somehow. She brought a couple of scent hounds with her, cast invisibility on them, and entered the hotel with the admonition to give her a few hours. She'd bind with them and coach them on what to search for. I might be able to do something similar, but could never achieve the same link she could, and be certain they had picked up the right scent. Her hunting experience and skill with animals put her in a completely different league from me. I took Pirun and Oberon to the Grand Café Orient, near the hotel. The café was determined to take advantage of the sunny weather in winter and offer outdoor seating. They had umbrellas over the tables to protect against sunburns or sudden rain, but I thought the latter was more likely, considering Pirun's sour disposition. Clouds began to form and whirl directly above us. Tourists walking down the cobbled street looked up at them, a bit worried, and then looked at Pirun as if the huge man wearing a blue sleeveless shirt on a chilly day was responsible. He was, of course. If there's some odd weather rolling in, you can almost always blame it on the big guy flaunting his hairy shoulders. People were trying to be cool about it and not stare, but they couldn't help themselves. They spotted him, dwarfing his chair, looking as out of place as one might expect a thunder god in an outdoor café to look, and smiled or laughed at him. A pair of Spanish tourists thought he was an eccentric local and wanted to take a picture with him, and he obliged, grateful for the attention. It cheered him up a bit, I think. After they left and we had Czech pilsners in front of us, Pirun began to speak of what troubled him. He had seen Granuaile recently, and she had suggested that Veles was working with Loki. Apparently, Pirun's old enemy had squirreled away another god of his pantheon and a horse used to divine the outcomes of battles. Pirun and Granuaile had found the horse, and Veles had found them, and then later Loki appeared briefly, proving the link. But they had not found the god Svantovit.
I am thinking I go looking for Shventovit, Perun said. Others of my peoples too. I thought all were burned by Loki, but maybe they live. The Zorius do. Flidish may help with looking for others, if Briet does not need her in Tir na n'Og.
I wish you luck with that. But if you don't mind backtracking a bit, do you know why Granuaile would concern herself with the horse?
She is wanting Cloak of Divination, which is in Poland, give to her if she give to them horse. Good witches who worship Zorius.
Interesting. Either she'd removed Loki's mark and wanted a cloak until she completed binding cold iron to her aura, or she hadn't and was hoping the cloak on top of the mark would shield her from Loki's sight. It was all news to me, and I felt a physical ache in my chest at the thought that I should be with the one I love, rather than chasing down vampires. And there was a dollop of guilt on top of it, melting like whipped cream on hot pie, for not thinking of her earlier. I could smell that strawberry lip gloss of hers, or at least the memory of it was so strong that it seemed to be in my nose right then. Oberon was thinking similar thoughts, presumably because the mention of Granuaile reminded him of her hound.
I miss Orla,
he said, and sighed heavily next to us. Hopefully we'll get to see her soon, I told him privately, and it meant Granuaile for me as much as it meant Orla for him. But it was good to hear that she was taking measures to protect herself. I was doing much the same. Removing Theophilus would theoretically remove his death sentence on druids, which would never have happened if I kept running when I should have. I shook my head at the realization that all I did anymore was fight to get back to that place where I had only one Irish god after my ass. Angus Og was long gone now, his spirit trapped in hell. But I supposed Fand could fill the role of Irish antagonist quite admirably from her prison. Perun and I waited at that cafe for more than a few hours, downing schooners of Pilsner and trading stories of older days, while Oberon napped. But eventually I was too cold to stand it anymore. The clouds had moved off as Perun's mood lightened, but the temperature was trending toward icy. You know what? I said. Let's go shopping. Flitish will find us wherever we are, right?
He's right. She does this to me before.
Good. Let's go.
What do we buy?
I need a jacket, I said, quite nearly shivering. I didn't want to employ the Earth's energy to raise my temperature when there was a simpler fix. Maybe we'll find one for you, too. Perun looked up at the sky and twisted his lips.
Okay. It's a little cold, maybe.
No maybe about it. A couple of queries on the street led us a few blocks south to a square full of fashion shops and sausage vendors. Oberon's tail sawed the air when he saw sausages just dangling from the ceiling of the kiosks. We paused to buy him a couple and then entered a store promising that there was couture inside, which meant I'd be paying for that word more than practicality. But I did manage to find a selection of leather jackets that would keep my core warm and also provide a handy inner pocket for Lukta's steak. I picked a brown one and hoped Granuaile would like it. Just like a seasoned shopping companion, Perun assured me that I had made a good choice.
He's very handsome. Too bad they no have jackets like this for my size. Flidish would love. She would be very excited and then tear from my body. Now that I think this, maybe it's good they no have my size.
It's too late,
Flidish said from behind us, smiling at Perun as she walked up to him.
Now that you've put the idea into me head, nothing will do, but I must have you in leather. I don't understand why humans like to wear dead cows,
Oberon grumbled, while Perun and Flidish made happy reuniting noises.
Cows are for eating.
Once Flittish pointed out that we were far easier to track from the Grand Bohemia than Theophilus, she let me know where to find my quarry.
"He's in Berlin,"
she said,
"and he has a significant entourage. He's staying at the Monbijou Hotel, in that neighborhood with all the museums and fancy restaurants."
I knew exactly where that was. There were some outstanding works of art in those